The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Good afternoon on this Tuesday afternoon, 5 on 5 on RedRTE.ie. Conor Pope will be with us very shortly to tell you how that low-key, drama-free budget has affected you. So if you have any questions for him, 5 on 5 on RedRTE.ie. But we're going to take a break from budget matters now. And what better way to do that than look at the top 10 toys for this Christmas? There you go. There's contrast for you. The top 10 toys are listed. I know, Halloween hasn't come and gone yet, and they're talking about toys for Christmas, but the Smith's catalogue arrived in our house a few weeks ago, and you can't hide it. It was found, and there are little people going through it and marking it off and making lists and checking them twice. That's the reality of it. Frozen 2, Arendelle Castle. You probably didn't even know there was a Frozen 2 if you don't have children of a certain age or grandchildren of a certain age. I don't think it's in the cinemas yet, but the toy is going to be much sought after this year, the castle. €179.99. Another movie, Toy Story 4, which is out during the summer, and the main character from that, Forky. You can get a push and talk Forky, which is number 9 in the must-have list. That's £30. Nerf, which is a perennial, particularly for boys. And I know you're going to say, no, it's not. No, girls like it too. It's mainly boys. Nerf is the gun thing that you have little sponge bullets in and you fire them. That's at number 8. At number 7, Barbie Travel Dream Plane. I'm looking at it here. It's all pink and blue as you'd expect. And people aren't they? They're campaigning now for gender-free aisles in toy shops. But the Barbie Travel Dream Plane isn't going to do anything for that campaign. Ryan's World Giant Mystery Egg. Seemingly, he's a child YouTuber. And that's £50. It features a mystery vehicle, ultra-rare figures, slime and putty. Everything you want. The LOL Surprise 2-in-1 Glamper Playset. Glamper as in glamping. I think that's... Is it Glamper? Has over 10 play areas, one exclusive doll, and more than 55 surprises to unbox. See, it's all about opening up boxes and getting surprises. That'll set you back $114.99, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Llamas are big this Christmas, and Pets Alive Boppy the Booty Shaking Llama. Boppy the Booty Shaking Llama will get the whole family up dancing. The llama toy has 3 songs which it twerks and spins to. So the Booty Shaking Llama. We had Brona Gallagher on Saturday night, and she is in Brassic, which is on one of the Sky channels, and it's a comedy, and her character has a pet llama. It's a llama in the thing, but it's actually in real life an alpaca. Anyway, as a result of that, I gave her 3 little llama figurines, and a number of people, as in 2, we got 2 emails. Where can we get the llamas that we saw on the telly on Saturday night? Well, they're called I Love Llama, and you'll get them in most newsagents, I think. They're little collectible things. I think they're about £3.50. Anyway, llamas are going to be big this year. You heard it here first. Lego Harry Potter Night Bus. Yeah, no surprises there. Paw Patrol. Be there in a hurry. I didn't realise they were still popular. £60 for the Paw Patrol Super Paws Mighty Jet Command Centre. And the top toy this Christmas is for real Cubby the Curious Bear. The perfect pet, they say. Cubby loves to play pick and poo and dances from time to time, and it'll cost you €85. There you go. Top 10 sought after toys this Christmas. Of course, if there's adults in your life, you're probably going to buy them a book. And I read somewhere, is it 60% or 70% of book sales are in the lead up to Christmas? There's a great survey in the papers today about the books that people lie about, as in the books that people said they read but they didn't. A new study has found that 56% of us have pretended to read a book to impress people, you know, employers, friends, potential suitors. You're sitting down over a romantic meal. You go, have you read Ulysses? Yes, of course I've read Ulysses. Yes, cover to cover. Very impressive, yes. James Joyce, my favourite author. Great singer too. The Bible is the book that most people lie about reading. Now, isn't that ironic? Isn't that the ultimate irony? So there you have. The Bible is the book that people lie about reading. To Kill a Mockingbird is number 2. And Ulysses, 4% of the population have said they've read Ulysses, but they haven't. Asked why they had lied about reading a book, 37% simply wanted to join a conversation about the book, while 31% said they did it to seem more intelligent. And 17%, I'm losing you now with all this percent, Sunday, about one in five people said they lied because they wanted to impress somebody on a date. I don't think I've ever lied about reading a book. I may have lied about finishing it, because I start a lot of books, and would have over the years, and not finish them. So I definitely started To Kill a Mockingbird. I can't remember finishing it. I'd love to read that, The Goldfinch. Jenny is raving about that book, and anybody I meet who has read it says it is absolutely brilliant. The movie's coming out soon, isn't it? The Goldfinch, or maybe it's out now. But it's 700 pages. I wouldn't feel the need to lie about reading a book. And TV as well. Do they, I suppose if you've been left out of a conversation, people say, you've seen Breaking Bad? You don't say, no, I haven't seen Breaking Bad actually. Well, you should say you haven't seen Breaking Bad, but people would lie about that too. Yeah. Well, we're on TV and movies and all that sort of thing. We have spotted, and now our suspicions have been confirmed, because there's an article about it in one of the papers today. English consumer expert with ITV, Martin Lewis, has given out about the lead-in time in cinemas. From the time, you know, you're supposed to be there, as in the movie's at 8:45, to the time that the movie actually starts, which in his case was 9:18. So that's 33 minutes. 33 minutes of ads and trailers. And he's saying, either cut pre-screening times or tell us actual start times. See, I like the fact that it doesn't start exactly when it's supposed to, because it gives you that little bit of wriggle room, doesn't it? Like, you know, if you're 5 or 10 minutes late, you're still going to get the beginning of the movie. Like, you'd really want to be very late to miss it. The other side of it is, you get your nachos or your popcorn or your very large bag of sweets. Why don't they sell normal size, please? Thank you very much. Well, it's all about profit, isn't it? So you have your catering pack of Maltesers in one hand and your extra large popcorn in the other, and you're balancing your large Coke on your nose. Anyway, with 33 minutes, you could get through all of that. You could get through all of that, and then the movie starts and you're sitting there and you've absolutely nothing. And I know what you're saying, just wait, just hold out. That's not human nature. You're at the cinema, you have the popcorn, you're going to eat it. You're not going to put it off for 33 minutes waiting for the feature to start. I like the trailers too, and most of the ads are entertaining. It doesn't bother me too much. The other B word, today's budget day, but he mentioned the other B word a lot, didn't he? Brexit. And it's the topic of a number of letters in the Irish Times today. Humorous ones. The very Reverend John F.A. Bond from Brockshane in County Antrim says, I wonder if there's any possibility of a Brexit-free day. No mention of Brexit in newspapers, on radio or television. I suspect I'm not the only person on this island who is fed up to the back teeth with this subject. Whatever about a backstop, surely a full stop for one day is not asking too much. Nice idea, Reverend John F.A. Bond, but it ain't going to happen. Not between here and the 31st of October. And Seamus Hegarty from Carry Duff in Belfast says, my prediction for Brexit is that it will be similar to a divorce after a long marriage. Costs increases, there's a lot more hassle, and we bump into each other all the time, which irritates both parties as each blames the other. And the legal profession are the only winners. Yours, Seamus Hegarty. There you go. What are you saying? 5151RadRTE.ie. I would think more people lie about music and pretend they know about bands. I heard of someone saying, I love Thin Lizzy, and the reply they got was, yeah, she's good, all right. That's Bernadette. That's great, Bernadette. I suppose music, yeah. Can't believe Flappy the Elephant didn't make the list. It is so cute. She says peek-a-boo with her ears and sings the rhyme, does your ear hang low? That's an old Barney one, isn't it? I can't remember the tune of it. Do your ears hang low? So Flappy the Elephant. Should the toy show just be recycled toys? Second-hand toys, sustainable toys, reusable toys. Even Lego has gone green with plastic. End the gross consumerism. Shame on your rate promoting plastic toys. I wasn't promoting them, I was just telling you about them. And you'll have to talk to somebody else about the toy show featuring sustainable toys. But we've been talking about it here on the show for quite some time now. Peak consumerism, it can't continue the way it's going with clothes and toys and everything else. The planet can't sustain that amount of buying. Stop mentioning prices when talking about kids' toys. Young ears are listening.
Sorry.
And on the budget, how do you work out if you are any better off after Budget 2020? Well, Conor Pope will be here, and the journal.ie have a Budget 2020 tax calculator in partnership with KBC. That'll give you an idea as well. We employ a nanny in our own home. Any support for us in the budget, we'll put that to Conor. And there's a lot more for Conor coming in there. Keep them coming in, 51551, ray@rte.ie. And we will put your questions to Conor Pope when we talk to him in about 5 minutes' time. Good afternoon. That's great. Tones and I. We've been listening to that at home for the last few weeks. It's one of those songs, it shouldn't be nice, shouldn't be something you'd want to listen to over and over again, but it is. Dan Smokey, Tones and I. 51551, ray@rte.ie. I agree with the message about cinema star times. When I go to the cinema, I just want to see the film. The one I've chosen to see, the one I've paid to see. I don't want to see ads from mobile phone companies and the usual shampoo ads. It's a joke. Nothing is free of ads anymore. Even YouTube is ruined with ads. Damien Kildare. Yeah, it is odd that you're paying in. I can understand YouTube because they have to make money, but you're paying into the cinema and they are making money showing you ads for shampoo and mobile phones, etc. I'd be afraid to lie about reading a book as you're leaving yourself wide open to be caught out. Okay, there's somebody agrees with me. What a strange but captivating song. Yes, I. That's it. The first time I heard it, I go, why do I love this? Why do I love this? But it'll grow on you. Tones and I. I sang Do Your Ears Hang Low at Guides 40 years ago, so it was long before Barney. Aha, he did a version of it. We'll have to get it and play it out. Just as soon as we've played Tones and I, we'll play Do Your Ears Hang Low. Do Your Ears Hang Low. The thing about Pascal Donoghue, Minister of Finance, and I know it's the way it's done, but it always grates with me that he uses the I word over and over again. I am going to, I will do this, I will do that. Because it's definitely a we thing, isn't it? It's a we will do this. We are going to do that. We, the government, we, the state, we, with the taxpayers' money. It's not I. But it shouldn't grate on me, but that's all I hear sometimes. I. 515511. RaidRTE.ie. We'll take a quick commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551. Val is benign, says, how about keeping it Irish and using the word film instead of movie? Don't you want your children to use that word? Keeping the Irishisms alive. Yeah, I'd prefer to say a film, Val, or film, as you used to say down in Kildare. But movie creeps in, doesn't it? And you find yourself saying movie. I worry, actually, about the future because you have very little young people's television on anymore and children aren't being exposed to Irishisms. Like some Egypt like myself and Dustin and Zig and Zag on daily. And talking, you know, like Irish people talk and mentioning places like Patrick's Well and Killaloe and all of those places. And I worry about the future and the knowledge of our country. You know, because, okay, school, there's geography and all that sort of thing, but in a sort of a casual, fun way, there's none of that about anymore. That's a worry. Anyway, Pascal Donoghue was on his feet for over an hour and our consumer champion Conor Pope was glued to his speech and he's on the lines now from Irish Times HQ.
How you doing, Ray? Glued to the speech I was. Couldn't get enough of it.
Speech. Initial reaction then, Conor.
Oh, listen, it's a very, very... I don't want to use the word dull, but it's a very careful budget. There isn't a whole lot in it for a whole lot of people. Now, Pascal Donoghue must have mentioned the word Brexit more than 20 times. And he said this was a budget that had been, quote, developed in the shadow of Brexit. And he said it would be wrong to take risks or to give people tax cuts that they may have to take back again in the next budget. So it was very much done with what might be happening in the weeks ahead in mind. And one of the first things that he announced as part of his budget measures was a rainy day fund that's going to be as much as 1.2 billion euros. And that money would be set aside for employment and to give relief to people who will be hardest hit in the event of a no-deal Brexit. People who work in the farming sector, people who work in the fishery sector, people who work in the tourism sector. So I think in that context, And it's important to say that's the context in which the budget was being unveiled. So with that in mind, I mean, what are the changes that people will feel? And the reality is that very few people will feel very many changes. I mean, the big thing, I suppose, if you're a smoker, is they announced a 50-cent increase on the packet of a price of 20 fags. Now, that's going to cost a smoker €250 a year if they're a 20-day, if they have a 20-a-day habit. Now, that's a fairly steep hit. That's going to hurt a lot of people in their pocket. But
wouldn't it be great if they ring-fenced the money they make from that to put
health.
It into for health? No, specifically for smoker health,
yeah.
Because the majority of people who smoke want to give them up.
You're absolutely right, and ring fencing is, funnily enough, it was a word that was mentioned. It was mentioned in terms of the carbon tax, and we were assured that the extra revenue that's going to be generated from the increase in carbon tax will be ring fenced, and it will be used to help with green initiatives and climate change and all that stuff. But I think a lot of people will be cynical about that, in the same way that a lot of people would say that wouldn't it be great if they ring-fenced all of the motor tax and used it to provide a proper infrastructure, and in the same way that if they ring-fenced the cigarette taxes and used them to provide a proper supportive network to help people to give up cigarettes, because I don't think there's very many people who smoke who are glad they smoke.
But
having said that, the 50-cent increase, it's not going to be enough to
deter them,
to deter a committed smoker. But what it might be, what it might do, is it might stop the 15-year-old or the 16-year-old taking up cigarettes, because a packet of cigarettes, a packet of 20 cigarettes is now going to cost $13.50. That's an awful lot of cash. So the cigarette thing was a big thing. There was an awful lot of attention in advance of the budget on the carbon taxes. And the carbon taxes, that is actually quite interesting. The tax is going to climb from 20 euro a ton to €26 a ton.
What does
that mean to you and me is the big question. It doesn't mean a whole lot. I'm not going to lie to you. It effectively adds 1 euro and 2 cent onto the cost of a 60-litre tank of petrol, and 1 euro and 18 cent onto the cost of a 60-litre tank of diesel. Now, over the course of a year, you're looking at an increase in your carbon tax of around €20. So if the idea of a carbon tax is to push people towards buying more environmentally friendly vehicles, either hybrids or electric cars, increasing the cost of driving by €20 a year or €25 a year isn't going to make a blind bit of difference. The other carbon tax initiatives will see the cost of, let's say, a 900-litre tank of home heating oil increasing by around €15, a 12.5-kilo bag of peat will cost around 16 cent more, around 72 cent added to the price of a bag of a 40-kilo bag of coal. But I think Pascal Donohue was very clever, because this had the risk of becoming a really, one of the things that the opposition would use to go at the government in the run-up to the budget. They could say this is a tax on the poor, it's unjust, it's going to increase the levels of fuel poverty in the country. So what Pascal Donohue has done is he's the auto taxes, the taxes on diesel and petrol, kick in at midnight tonight. But for the rest of the carbon tax increases, they won't kick in until after the winter. And after the winter, that will also conveniently be after the general election, most likely.
Okay.
So that was the big thing.
And Leo did say, when he was at the climate change summit in UN, that they would ring-fence carbon tax for things specifically to do with climate change.
Exactly. Yeah. And so some of those measures will be to create employment schemes for people who are living in the Midlands who might have where Bord na Mona would employ a lot of people. There'll also be initiatives aimed at improving the cycling infrastructure, aimed at improving the environmental benefits of all of the peatland, the bogs in the Midlands. And there's around 30 or 40 million euros to be ring fenced for that. And then apart from the carbon taxes, there's also been small tax credit bumps for people who are self-employed and for home carers. There's been an increase in the inheritance threshold and a widening of access to prescription drugs and medical services for children. Now, for instance, so when it comes to the tax credit bumps, if you're self-employed, you'll get an extra €150 a year, because your tax credit is being increased by €150 a year. Same with the home carers; that's being increased by €150. And home carers would mean that if there's a couple, one of them is staying at home to look after the kids, and the other is going out to work, well, then the person who's going out to work gets an extra bounce on their tax credits. Yeah. And then from next September. And again, these are things that are somewhere off in the distance. There will be a free medical care for kids up to the age of 8 and free dental care for kids up to the age of 6. And then, as I say, the inheritance threshold, the inheritance tax threshold, by that I mean the threshold at which a parent can will money to their offspring is going from €320,000 to €335,000.
What about social welfare changes, Conor?
There's been very few social welfare changes. And the other big thing is housing. Now, a lot was made in Pascal Donohue's speech about what they've done for housing. I suppose the bottom line is they will increase the housing budget by around €200 million. Now, that sounds like a lot, but I think it is worth bearing in mind that an awful lot of that €200 million will be going into the pockets of private landlords in the form of the housing assistance payment scheme.
200 million isn't a lot when it comes to housing.
No, not if you're building houses.
No,
it's not a lot at all if you're building houses.
The average cost of building a house is 200,000. That's 5 per million. So that's 1,000 houses.
You're absolutely right. But like when you hear the sums like 200 million, you might be tempted.
Yeah.
One might be tempted if you're just paying casual attention.
Of course.
That's a lot of cash.
And then he said there was an increase of the building of 62%. On 2016, but it was a very low base.
Very low base. So, yeah, to play devil's advocate, it's a difficult time because we don't know what's coming down the tracks in the event of a hard Brexit, and things could go very badly wrong very quickly. But if the big issue facing the country at the moment, and it is the big issue for a huge number of people, is a lack of good quality affordable housing, I'm not sure if enough are by any means has been done to tackle that in this budget.
We said you were coming on. We've just a couple, not many specific questions you might answer. We employ a nanny in our own home. Any support for us in budget?
No.
I think not, even though it's the most expensive kind of childcare. Tired mum.
No, there isn't any.
No.
Well,
okay.
Certainly, I mean, like there hasn't been. Now, there has been the increase in the tax-free allowance for home care. So if you're staying at home yourself, you'll get a tax benefit. But I don't think there's been any allowances given for people who employ nannies at home.
Teresa wants to know about the diesel and the petrol. You've answered that already. Imelda says, full-time carer received a reduced contributory pension last year, but the powers that be reduced my carer's allowance by half.
Yeah.
Surely as I paid PRSI qualified me for reduced pension, that shouldn't have affected the carer's allowance. I still give full-time 24/7 care. More difficult now that I'm older. This has to be unjust.
Yeah, that is unjust. And it's quite a specific query, and I'm not sure if there was anything actually announced in the budget that will make that listener feel any better. I'm just trying to look through it here. There might be some allowances for people in that situation, but certainly it wasn't one of the top lines in the speech.
And oftentimes, as the day goes on, people spot things, don't they?
Exactly.
In the small print. Smoking 20 cigarettes a day works out at over 4,000 a year.
That's correct,
that person,
yeah. And bear in mind, that's €4,000 after tax. So if you but I mean, it's very easy to condemn the smoker. But I think we also have to have a degree of sympathy for the smoker.
Because
nobody in their right mind chooses to spend 10 grand gross on a habit that is only going to kill them.
Mm.
You know, it's an addictive substance, and if we're pointing the finger here, you have to be pointing the finger squarely at the cigarette makers.
Yeah. I said that about the I versus we. Is that the dumb thing when you're a minister? You use the I instead of the we?
What's that?
I agree with you about the I. We, it's a team working together and acknowledges everyone's contribution. So much nicer to say we. This is, he says, Pascal Dunne, who says I all the time. Thanks for referring to the minister's use of I when referring to the management of the budget. I agree, it's irritating. We, on behalf of the people, will be a much better use of language, as Mary.
I think it's pretty standard, though, that the Minister for Finance does
say I.
While they're taking credit for things in the good times, during the bad times, they also have to use I.
Do they?
I don't know. I think so.
It'd be an interesting study. If every minister said I and took responsibility for the decisions, the country would be better off. It's PJ in Mayo.
Yeah, well, yeah. It could be right, but I mean, if he was using I a lot, if there was a lot of I strain today, it wasn't because he was announcing big bonuses for everybody, because there's nothing like that in the budget at all.
Okay. So, uneventful, I suppose.
Quiet,
okay. Connor, back to work with you. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
And there'll be more budget analysis on Drive Time at 4:30 today on RT Radio 1.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or ray at rte.ie. Now, we spotted an article on image.ie by Dominique McMullen, who's a first-time mum. And she's been writing about the reality of motherhood and the fact that maybe she wasn't told the truth about it Dominic joins us in studio. How are you doing, Dominic?
Hi, I'm good.
So 5.5-month-old little Kai.
Yeah. He's just in studio there being looked after by your colleagues.
Yeah, and you wrote a letter to him.
Yeah, I did. I think I kind of went into motherhood not really expecting what came. I had a really nice pregnancy and I was, I knew it wasn't going to be easy. I was ready for the challenge. And it was just a bit of a shock. I felt a little bit lied to by... I had women who talked to me and who'd said to me kind of quietly little things like, you know, if you ever need a chat and here's my phone number, you know, to talk about whatever it is at 2 o'clock in the morning. But I just don't think there's an actual kind of national conversation out in the open about how difficult it really is to be a mum, especially for the first time. I found it just a shock.
Did you?
Yeah, you did, yeah.
Well, maybe people are protecting you from the truth, but once you've told them you're pregnant, there's no, like... There's no going back.
Yeah. So. I a lot of people have said that they want to protect young mums and new mums, but I actually think that's a bit of a disservice to young women. I think that they're not going to not get pregnant because they hear that it's tough. They're not going to turn around and, you know, and freak out about it. I think young women are really powerful. They're strong. They can take it. But to be not told anything is a lot worse.
Okay.
You know?
What were you not told then? What shocked you?
Just the overall experience. Like I had, my birth was not what I expected it to be. I went into the birth, I'd done a lot of hypnobirthing. I had kind of, you know, fake candles and spa music. And
you had a birth plan?
I didn't have a birth plan. Okay. Because I know that that's not really a great idea.
Okay.
I knew it never goes the way you expect it to go. But it really, really didn't. It was, and I think I was unlucky in that. And I know that lots of women do.
What's
have...
What's hypnobirthing? Is it where you don't use pain relief?
You can use pain relief, right. But it's that you kind of do lots of visualization techniques and kind of calm yourself, and you go into the whole situation feeling positive about it and using your breathing. But the birth kind of shocked me. So from the start, I felt like I was on the back foot because of that.
Well, what in particular shocked you about it?
It was just a tough birth. I was unlucky. I had all the painkillers. My first epidural didn't work, and there was lots of kind of issues around it. But it wasn't just the birth. It was everything then afterwards. It was kind of, my hormones were all over the place, as they are, which is really normal. And I just... I cried a lot. You have to wake up every 2 hours to feed them in the middle of the night, and because of the birth I was physically not well, but then emotionally I was all over the place. I think what made all of that worse is that I didn't know that that was normal.
Yes.
And I thought that there was something wrong with me. I mean, I know about postnatal depression. I didn't think I had postnatal depression. I wasn't sure. I just was worried that I was abnormal and that I was finding it so, so hard.
So there was a huge gap between your expectations and the reality.
Yeah, there was.
And you're not blame is a big word, but you're suggesting that maybe if people had been a little bit more honest with you, that gap wouldn't have existed.
Important that women know that if you're finding it really, really hard, that's okay.
Yes.
And you're not a failure because of that. And it's not abnormal. And it doesn't mean you have postnatal depression. I mean, it might. And that is a very serious, you know, thing that affects lots of women. But you can also just have the baby blues and feel a bit down and it be hard and have crap days. Like, we all have crap days.
You work as a journalist.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder, is it that women didn't have a voice to say these things until recently? I don't know. Is it?
No, I think you're right. I think it's a number of reasons. I think that's one of the reasons. I think women now, you know, more than ever in the last decade are having a voice where they didn't have one before, and they're talking about things that weren't spoken about before. I also think there's a bit of kind of shame and mum guilt around talking about these kind of things, because I think people feel like it might sound like they don't love their baby, you know, to the ends of the earth, or that that they're a bad mum or they're failing in some way, because not every situation is positive. But I think what I just want people to understand is that there are amazing highs. I mean, my little boy is the best thing in the whole world, as every mum I'm sure would say, but there's also really low lows.
And I suppose maybe something to do with the human brain as well. You know, that when you get out the other side, it's the joyous things that you remember.
Yeah, you wipe away the bad memories. Yeah,
because how often have you heard, you're expecting to, it's going to be the most joyous occasion in your life. It'll change your life completely in a positive way. Yeah. And it's all that.
And those things are all true.
Yes, but they don't then qualify
don't
it
remember.
A bit by you'll have a few couple of tough months and maybe you'll have a problem breastfeeding. Was breastfeeding a huge problem?
I was really lucky in that breastfeeding wasn't such a problem. I mean, it was still a problem in that it's hard. You know, the first few weeks are really hard and that it's kind of the relentlessness of it. But I was lucky in that it kind of worked. It was the whole scenario for me was just unexpectedly bad. I knew it wasn't going to be easy.
Yeah, poor thing.
No, sure, I'm grand now. I mean, I'm still in it. And like, he's only 5.5 months. I know there's a lot more to come. But yeah, I just really want women to talk about it more, you know?
When you actually, you know, lay it out as it happens.
Yeah.
It's no surprise that it's tough. You know,
no.
Sleep deprivation.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a tough birth, you're not well. If you have a cesarean, it's major surgery.
So,
you know, like you've had major surgery, then you're sleep deprived.
Yeah. And your hormones. I mean, don't underestimate the power of those hormones. I watched Planet Earth on day like 5 or 6, and it was unfortunately the scene where the walruses, have you seen Planet Earth, the walruses all jump off the cliff and commit suicide.
Oh.
Awful. I sobbed and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed.
Yeah.
And half an hour later I was the happiest I've ever been. You know, it is a real roller coaster of emotions. I can hear him in the studio there.
He can hear your voice probably.
Yeah. Okay, Kai.
So it's getting easier.
It's getting so much easier. Yeah. I mean,
what about your partner?
He's amazing. Yeah. I was actually trying to figure out today about the extra two weeks paternity leave and the budget. He is lucky enough that he had his own business, so he was able to support me for the first kind of 8 weeks if he hadn't have been there.
That's a luxury, isn't it?
Oh, such a luxury.
Because so many women, including my Jenny, report and talk about the day where their partner
leaves.
So I think I was off for 2 weeks. The first when Kate was born, and then looking
it's
at
not enough.
Oh no!
I mean, I really would have been lost without him. He was a pillar of support for me. My mum also, you know, came over and just cooked meals, and everybody tiptoed around me. I think another really important thing about that period is that, I mean, I was lucky in a way because the doctor said, look, he'd had a bit of a thing after birth. They said, don't have any people handling him or too many guests for the first 3 or 4 weeks. And that was such a blessing. I kept everyone away. I just had my mum and my husband and a few close family. And I don't know how in Irish culture we have this thing where everybody piles over in the first few weeks.
Because we've been talking to Tanya Sweeney about her pregnancy and her birth, and that was the thing she was saying as well.
Like, it's madness.
Yeah.
And to be up making tea for guests and trying to keep the house clean, like, who wants to be doing that when you have a tiny newborn?
Doesn't make sense.
No, it's the opposite. And lots of other cultures, they do keep the guests away for the first month. So I think we need to...
Let's see what they're saying. I'm a mum of three, and this is so true. People don't talk about how hard it is. I felt the same. I now find myself opening up and talking about struggles to friends who are new mums. It drives me mad when people talk about what a lovely time having a new baby is and to cherish the bonding and precious time with the baby, etc. It can make new mums feel awful because invariably they don't like that.
Yeah.
We need to be much straighter with each other for all of our sakes, says Maria.
Yeah, and it's interesting what she says, that once you kind of become a mum, you suddenly become in this little club and all the other mums suddenly gather around you and say, it's okay, it is shite, you know. But they don't say that.
They don't say before.
Too late. Yeah.
I've been honest about my motherhood ups and downs. I'm not on Instagram, etc. And I think that's the hole that everyone falls into. It's not perfect. It's hard. It's lonely. I don't have any family around and therefore I have to get on with it. Yeah. Whether I sink or swim, your guest is good enough and that is enough. Keep on keeping on, says Maeve.
Thanks, Maeve.
And O'Jays is Ray. I'm at home here with a 5-week-old. He's my second son. I'm breastfeeding and I thought it would be much easier this time round. It's not. It's so hard and it definitely takes a village to raise a child. And that, I suppose that's a problem as well, the way the world has gone.
Yeah. We're also isolated. Small,
yes. And they're smaller families and the luxury of an extended family doesn't exist for an awful lot of people.
Yeah, I know. No, I've said oftentimes talking to other new mums that if we all lived in, you know, a village... you know, in a tribal village like we would have however long ago, it would all be so much easier.
But
we'd even, all be helping each
but
other.
But even my generation, like our granny lived across the green from us.
Yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? And she was over every afternoon to help my mum out.
Yeah.
You know, so it's changed in that in
yeah,
two generations.
In that time.
Yeah. Well, I'm quite old. I'm glad to hear Dominique talk openly about this. As a sleep consultant, I talk to a lot of mums, and this is a huge issue. Mums feel guilty and ashamed because they aren't loving every moment. Motherhood is hard. We need to be open and honest about how we feel. And you're missing little Kai out there. I can see you're looking out.
Maternity. Yes, he's fine. I can see him.
Lisa has two of her own, and she's just back from maternity leave, so she's
good.
She's,
yeah. In good hands.
Yeah, yeah. She's match fit. So more conversations about this.
Yeah. And I think the social media point there is really interesting. I think, you know, social media can be a real issue around this, and that people are portraying, you know, beautiful, magical rainbow times. But it's also, for me, been a really nice tool to talk to other mums and to kind of feel support from other mums. That there is a real kind of group in there, that once you kind of are following the right people and talking to the right people, that it's been a massive support for me.
And the other thing which we haven't hit on, I don't know if it happened with you, is the realisation that this is for real and forever.
Oh, stop. Yeah, I know. That gave me a real fright.
Did it, yeah?
Which sounds ridiculous. You know, I was pregnant for 9 months and I meant to get pregnant, but suddenly when you have a little baby in your arms, it is like, whoa. There won't be one day when I don't have this baby for the rest of my life, you know? Touch wood, God bless and all that. But yeah, it's a shock.
See, all of those things.
Beautiful.
With the
and
hormones
wonderful
and the sleep deprivation and all that. So yeah.
You're a lucky man, Ray.
Yeah. Well, I'm lucky that I'm a man. Is that what you're
saying?
That's
what I mean. Yeah. Exactly.
As opposed to a lucky man, yeah. I agree. First baby is so incredibly hard, but I never tell expecting mothers what to expect, because when I did, they never listened. So I stopped. I think it's right that people have their own experiences, but have and need support after the birth. No birth is easy, no birth. The expectations were much less of women years ago. We are so lonely and often far from family now. Be brave. Sing. Pram Jam Singers is a choir where... Oh, sorry. Pram Jam Singers is a choir where you can bring your baby. Great to hear for your mental health is more. I don't know what that is.
That sounds great.
Yeah. That's a Pram Jam. That sounds
there's
great.
There's a few great mum groups, actually. You know, there's a few really supportive kind
are
of...
Are these online?
Yeah. No, in real life.
In real life.
IRL. Yeah.
All right. I've never heard that expression before. IRL.
Yeah,
in real life.
In real life.
Okay.
There's a gym that I go to, Empowered Mama. They do workouts with your baby,
right,
or swim clubs where you can go and swim with your baby. There's great things out there, but you have to go and look for them, you know, like any of these things.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming in, and good luck. And it's a pity I can't get to meet Kai there. He seems happy enough out there.
He's waving.
We'd hear
you.
Him if he was crying.
Yeah.
Dominic McWillan. And so
thanks,
you write for Image.ie.
I do, yeah.
How long are you off for?
I'm going back at the beginning of next year.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in, Dominic.
Thank you for having me.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551 or ray@rte.ie. Now, it's a statistic that we've mentioned before on the show, and it's a very stark statistic. 7 times more traveller men and 6 times more traveller women take their own lives through suicide compared to the general population. And that's figures that were gathered by the National Traveller Mental Health Network. Representatives from traveller advocate groups appeared before TDs and senators today to highlight this as part of Mental Health Awareness Week. And Thomas McCann is a member of the travelling community, and he's director of the Traveller Counselling Service, who addressed the Oireachtas Joint Committee on key issues earlier on today, and he joins us in studio. How are you doing, Thomas?
Not too bad.
Had you addressed a government committee before?
I did. It was there was an all party committee on mental health, future mental health in Ireland, which did a report and had recommendations in it. And so we did a presentation to them and a submission to them in the past. That's about 6 or 7 months ago.
Is it a nerve wracking thing to do?
It is, yeah, it is. And you know, kind of like, going into any situation where there's a number of people kind of that you're presenting to, and they're going to question you about stuff, is nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
But going into an Oireachtas committee is a bit more, you know. So.
And of course, you're representing your community as well on a very serious issue.
Yeah, it's and you don't know what questions you're going to be asked.
Yes,
so,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
But I have to say the committee was very supportive. You know.
You're at the coalface So you're hearing the concerns and worries and anxieties of the travelling community firsthand.
Yeah. And I mean, like, it is a national issue. I mean, you were saying there about the figures, you know. A number of studies at this stage has shown that it's across the nearly every traveller family in Ireland is affected by suicide and mental health. And like, if you go anywhere around the country, I mean, if you went out now and kind of went somewhere and there was a group of travellers in the room and you asked how many is affected by suicide, most of the people in the room would put up their hands, if not them all.
Right.
In every single situation.
So they reckon 30 already this year. That's from a population of 40,000.
Which is a huge amount. Yeah. I mean, somebody said once, I think it was Martin, said once that, like, if you look at an All-Ireland final day, 80,000 people file into Croke Park. Like, the whole travel community in Ireland wouldn't half fill.
Yes, Croke Park.
Croke Park.
Yeah.
And I mean,
and imagine, like, 30 of those people just, and the year isn't over yet.
Yeah, and it's become such a, you know, a frequent occurrence that.
And is it on the increase, Thomas?
It is, yeah. There's more travel women now dying by suicide, you know, whereas it was primarily travel men. Now it is much more travel women dying by suicide. And, you know, kind of, that's very worrying. I mean, it's worrying the situation that we're in, but.
The National Traveller Survey makes for hugely interesting reading because there's comparisons from 2017 to the year 2000. And things have changed quite considerably.
Yeah.
So back in the year 2000, when asked how was their life, 26% of travellers considered that life in general to be better.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in 2017, said that it wasn't.
Yeah. And I mean, in a number of different...
Sorry, I get that right now. Sorry, I read that wrong. Yeah. Back in 2000, 61% said that their life had improved over the last 5 years. And then in 2017, only 26% said it improved.
Yeah. The improvement, has got less and less. But I mean, it's not only since 2000. I mean, if you look at the study that was carried out in 1987 by a man called Dr. Joe Barry, you find that the statistics, like around traveller life expectancy, were better for travellers than they are now.
Right.
I mean, I think it was 12 years less then for a traveller man. Now it's 15 years less. And that was 1987.
Okay. So what's happening? Like, travellers are less nomadic. That's
less nomadic. Well, there's a number of reasons for that as well. I mean, of course, the trespass.
But I'm wondering, is the fact that they're less nomadic, is that affecting their mental health?
Absolutely, because you're stuck in the place. One, you know, being nomadic, you're not, you were able to move. You were able to kind of, and it's not even, nomadism is not about moving from A to B. It's a mindset that you're able to move on. Or if there are
it's a choice, is it?
Yeah, well, it's a choice that you can travel, that you can move.
It's self-determination. You have self-determination.
And it was for numerous reasons, you know, in the past, including economic, social, and psychological as well. There was, and being with family, extended family.
So that's one thing that has changed. They feel marginalised. We know that from the research.
Yeah, well, that's there for a very long time. I mean, there's a marginalisation. And, kind of the studies that's been carried out, I mean, Micheál McGrail carried out a study and a number of other people. And they reckon that marginalisation and discrimination has got worse since the 1970s.
And how is that articulated by people who come to you, for example?
Well, it's in the stress and anxiety. I mean, the thing about nomadism, if you're in a situation where you can't move, where you can't travel now because your caravan will be taken off you within 48 hours. If you don't move, so you can't move. It's a criminal issue now rather than a civil issue, and at the same time, there's local authorities are not building traveller specific accommodation. The discrimination in the rented and private sector, and indeed sometimes in local authority areas, is really hard to get a place to live. So you feel stuck. So you're stuck in a situation that you end up in overcrowded conditions, sometimes with people that you mightn't get on with, and you can't move. You're unemployed.
You're talking about a halting site.
Halting site, okay. You know, kind of in most cases.
So traditionally, if you didn't get on with somebody, you just move on. on.
You could move on. It was a way of kind of...
But I suppose, you know, the settled community, for want of a better phrase, we have to live beside people we don't like either sometimes, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, if the proper accommodation... And, I mean, you have to take culture into account. And, I mean, it's very important, the whole cultural aspect of this, because, you know, some families didn't live in big groups of people. There wasn't huge groups of travellers living together. Like, it was extended families that lived together traditionally and moved and was nomadic. So, the idea of sites, traveller halting sites, people think travellers came up with that idea. It wasn't travellers who came up with that. It was
imposed upon them.
It was the Commission for Itinerancy that came up with sites.
So, education.
Education, yeah. Education, traditionally, I mean, travellers have been educationally disadvantaged. I mean, but even the travellers who have access to education, the education system has really let travellers down. I mean, I went, well...
But Thomas, you're a traveller, but is education something that's valued within the traveller community?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, education is highly valued. I mean, you can see that by the number of adults that's come back to education, including myself.
But is that a recent thing, though?
No, it wouldn't be. It wouldn't be. Like, I remember my mother, for instance, and a number of other travellers, like, even when they were travelling, they would do everything they could to get their children into the local school, even for a very short period of time. It was very difficult, though, because many schools, and you can talk to others about this as well, many schools wouldn't take travellers in. I mean, there was a case there a couple of years ago. That was only a recent case, but there was a lot of situations. Yes. But the other thing was that travellers who did go to school, when they were in school, there was sometimes different play times. There was terrible incidents where you kind of had, you know, a line drawn in the middle of the yard in some schools.
That's all right.
You know, and
so there's discrimination when it comes to education, when it comes to employment, when it comes to social activities.
Yeah. So you're excluded from it.
And that obviously impinges on your mental health, which in some cases eventually leads to people taking their own lives.
Absolutely. Well, also, I was at a conference in Donegal last week, and they were looking at alcohol and the connection between alcohol and suicide.
Huge connection.
And binge drinking is connected in some ways to suicide. And if you look at that if you're, for young people and indeed other people, like if you're excluded from clubs and public houses and all the rest of it, a lot of younger travellers will get a carry out. And so it increases
the different
the
type
likelihood
of, drinking. Yes.
Of binge drinking. Drinking.
Yes.
And so, you know.
So I'm sorry we don't have more time with you today, but what then, in your chats with the traveller community and the various groups, what do you think the solutions are? Obviously the solutions are going to come from without and within. What are the things from within that need to be changed?
Well, I think within, it's kind of that there are factors that need to change within. There's a huge stigma around mental health, huge shame around mental health, and you know that sometimes travellers are reluctant to go for help or to talk to somebody because there's a shame around it. They think they've failed themselves rather than looking at how does these things come about. And if you look at all the stresses, I mean, the stress in everybody's life, earlier on you were talking to a mother.
The stress,
the ordinary everyday stress that people have, when that's combined with
been marginalised
with
and
all
discriminated
of this other
against,
stuff, it's very difficult for people. So there really is a need for, and the community is moving in this direction, for people to support one another, to go and talk to somebody about it.
And what about masculinity in the travelling community?
Masculinity, well, the travel community is like any other community. There's a diversity of people, like, you know, and again, it's like, you know, sometimes stereotypes don't allow for diversity.
I understand that completely. But
so masculinity is very strong among some men and other men.
Yeah, but I suppose, you know, you talked earlier on about the traveller culture.
Yeah,
and different
yeah.
cultures have
yeah.
different attitudes to masculinity.
Of course, it is. But in terms of, like, you know, kind of the roles that the traditional roles that men would have played has been breaking down.
Yes.
I mean, if you look at, you know, kind of, and indeed the women as well, I mean, with the changes that's gone on, like a lot of them roles, each generation as well, kind of in every culture, kind of changes. The culture is not a static thing.
No, I know.
Culture changes.
Yes.
So, So the roles has changed, even in terms of ways of making a living.
And that brings pressure.
Traveller economy. Like, you know, as I said, 84% unemployment, okay. You know.
There's been three presentations on this to committees, hasn't there?
There has been
one more. There's going to be three, Tuesday, yes. Yeah. So maybe would you come back into us?
Because we only had
10 minutes on that, and it demands and deserves a lot more time.
Yeah, and just the one point I'd say about it, within and without, I mean, it needs to be a collaborative approach between, you know, the traveller community.
Hasn't that been a problem, though, over the years?
It has,
lack
of
collaboration between the settled community and the travelling community.
There's a social distance.
Why? Yeah.
And that's when there's a process in academia called othering.
Right.
And one of the elements of that is creating a social distance between the other that's excluded. And that social distance is there and has been there for a very long time. We need to address that.
Is there any lack of trust on the part of the travelling community, of the settled community?
There is, but it wouldn't be the same. It wouldn't be in the same as the settled community have of travellers. Yeah. It's not the same dynamic that goes on. I mean, of course,
it's different.
It'd be more individuals. I mean, I'm married to a settled woman. I'm sure she's might be less than at the minute, but a lot of other travellers. But it wouldn't be the same. The mistrust and the fear that the settled community have is sometimes a general mistrust. It's not because an individual does something or that.
It's a stereotypical mistrust.
Absolutely. Yes, and that keeps that social distance in place.
Okay. Thomas, thanks so much for coming in, and we will talk to you again.
Okay, thanks very much. Yeah. And
thanks very much for that. 51551 for your text. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. We're staying with sport. We welcome to studio Leinster rugby player Dave Carney. Good afternoon, Dave.
All right.
How are you?
Good, thanks.
Congratulations on your hat-trick against Benetton for Leinster. That's a good start to the season.
Yeah, great start. Tough game, tough place to go to. Treviso, definitely a team who have improved a lot over the last couple of years. Wasn't the prettiest of performances, but got the result, which is the main thing.
Is that your first hat-trick for Leinster?
I think so, yeah, it is. It's funny how those games go. I mean, you know, sometimes you'll touch the ball 15 times, sometimes you'll touch the ball twice. It's just how those games go. I didn't have much to do for a couple of them now. But always nice to get.
Yeah. And is there any ritual around getting a hat trick? Do you get a hat or a special jersey or the bumps or anything like that?
Not really. No, pat in the back.
That's it, is it?
Yeah.
Is there no board up in the Leinster clubhouse of hat trick scorers? No.
I don't know when the last hat trick was. I think it could have been a couple of years ago. Barry Daly got one. But it's funny then because Roland Keller, Hooker, got one. Weekend gone. Against Ospreys.
Two hat tricks. Yeah.
A lot of tries been scored, which is good.
Yeah. You're here as an official ambassador for Bord Bia.
Exactly, yeah.
Today is World Egg Day.
World Egg Day, yeah, it is. Which
have you got your photograph taken with a large egg yet?
Yeah, absolutely, of course. Well, first thing this morning.
Right.
You've had
your eggs already today, haven't
I have.
You?
Eggs are it's more convenient, if anything. They're just so handy to have. You can have them with literally any meal, you know, breakfast, obviously, have it lunch, dinner, outside your three main meals. You can have them with snacks too, omelettes, you know, easy way of sourcing that protein. Which
they enhance most meals as well.
Exactly.
Like I put an egg on my pizza.
Yeah, so yeah. I've done, yeah.
Nasi goreng, fried egg on top.
Eggs on steak.
Yeah, eggs on. I've done that as
dinner.
Well.
It all work.
There's nothing that isn't improved by putting an egg on top.
That's it. So I think people obviously sometimes have a myth as well about not eating that many eggs a day, or they think
that was a myth. Yeah, but too much cholesterol.
Eggs every single day. Yeah.
So you had them scrambled. That's how you prefer them in the morning, is it?
Depending on how much time I have as well.
Right. Do you cook your own breakfast?
No, we don't actually. Well, depending on the day, your day off you would, but we have great food in the club. We come in at 7 in the morning and we have breakfast in the club.
Nice.
We have lunch in the club too, so.
Isn't that what they say about professional sports people? That, you know, there you are, you're a 30-year-old man And you're told really what to do, what to eat, exactly. Where to go, and then you come out at the other side of that and you go, oh well, where's somebody, who's going to tell me
how do I cook eggs,
how do I live my life? Yeah,
that's great. I mean, like, and that's what I mean, it's changed so much, like I mentioned before, in the last, you know, 10 years. Yeah. And we wouldn't have had that back then. Yeah. Whereas now, you know, we have that, which is great, and it's a good way for the nutritionists to keep on top of lads and making sure that they're keeping the, you know, the discipline. Yeah.
I know, you know, you like me and all that, but you'd prefer to be somewhere else, wouldn't you? Let's be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to be in Japan, of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. How tough is that? How do you get your head around it? Because
you get your head around it quickly, to be honest, because you have to. You can't spend time dwelling on, you know, I'm missing out on things like this. And because for me, it was, you know, I found out on a Sunday that I wasn't going, and you're back into Leinster on a Wednesday. So you don't really have time to think. You know, for me, I just wanted to get back in and, you know, get back training, get back playing as quick as possible. And we had a pre-season game the following week, so which is great. Kind of takes your mind off things, you know, and get back into it. But it was definitely positives for me. If I was to look back to, you know, 2 years ago when I wasn't in a great place, even a year and a half ago, you know, I was getting injury after injury. And
how does that affect you mentally?
It's tough, yeah. It's definitely. I think when, you know, you go a couple of seasons and you get a big injury, it's easier to deal with. But I think when you're getting injury upon injury upon injury, it's definitely tougher. I definitely, you know, had some tough times over those couple of years, and you know, that I worked my way back into the Leinster squad, and then to the Irish squad for the World Cup. Then that was definitely a positive for me to get back to where I did. Trying to take the positives is always very important too.
And you were called up for the first of the warm up games against Italy.
Yeah, played the Italy game, played the Wales away game, as well. So, I really enjoy being back in that environment. I think my last game before that was probably over a year and a half.
What you play those games? It's like a big audition, isn't it? It's like you're.
It's funny, yeah. It's way different to any other preseason game because it's a friendly, but you know it's actually not for you. It's not a friendly at all. A Leinster friendly, you're gone out and you could be playing an English team and in front of, you know, a few hundred people, a couple of thousand, but you know, for this you're going out and you're playing for your country in front of 50,000-60,000 people,
and you're playing for your place on
exactly,
in the squad.
Yeah, it's a trial game as well. You know, you're a lot of pressure on you to perform. It's not where you can, you know, kind of ease your way into things, you know, first game of the season, you know, get the cobwebs off, it's full on, this is your chance, and you know, if you don't take it, well then, you know, you're going to be a step behind.
And what about, we had Conor Murray in a few months ago before he went to Japan, and that thing that's constantly at the back of your mind, okay, you have to impress, but you don't want to get injured.
Yeah.
It's
funny, it's probably different for different players, you know, depending on where you lie.
When you say where you lie,
as in, I'm not saying people are guaranteed.
Oh yeah, I see what you're saying.
To get selected, but people are in better positions.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
For lads like me, who, you know, really needed to play and to perform, well then that's completely out the window. You can't hold back whatsoever. You got to give it 100%, and injury is obviously a risk. It's a risk every time you go out to play, and it's no different. But it's funny, when we do contact sessions during training, if you hold back or if you don't go 100%, you actually hurt yourself.
Yeah, yeah, they say that. Yeah,
it's kind of funny. But it was definitely full out from the start.
And a lot was made of the fact that Devin Toner didn't make the squad. Mm-hmm. So he was raised up as the one person who would have been very disappointed. Do you have chats about it? About not being selected?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, yeah, of course. They're the lads you can actually properly have a chat and get it all off your chest. And, you know, you're all in the same boat. You're going through the same emotions.
This is going to sound like an odd question. Did you cry?
No. No, didn't cry.
You don't cry?
To be honest, I didn't start that Wales game. I had a bit of a feeling that I wasn't going to get selected. So it didn't come as a complete shock to me. Mm. Whereas, you know, maybe Devin did come to him more of a shock. Yeah. But like I said, you don't have time to do it. You don't want time.
So you're back into the lens of thinking you're scoring
exactly.
hat-tricks.
You want to get back in, get back playing and, you know, back into the environment and kind of forget about it as quickly as you can.
But then it's all around you. You know, it's all around you, the World Cup. And started off brilliantly, beat Scotland well, then the Japan game. Mm-hmm. And then we beat Russia and now we have Samoa. And depending on what happens, we could come first or second. So we're playing New Zealand or South Africa in the quarterfinals. We're most definitely going to qualify, aren't we?
Yeah, you'd like to think so. Yeah. I mean,
but then we were probably definitely going to beat Japan, and we didn't beat.
Yeah, well, confident now we'll get the bonus point
against Samoa.
We're always going to be playing South Africa or New Zealand, which is pretty tough in itself.
Have you played against both of those teams?
Yeah, I played in the game in the Aviva where we lost in the last.
Which
was good.
Heartbreaking, yeah.
But the belief is there, obviously, because, you know, we have beaten New Zealand twice now over the last couple of years. So the belief is there that we can do it. The monkey's off the whack in that sense. You know, South Africa, another class team.
Yeah. And a lot of people are talking about how big they are.
They're huge, yeah, absolutely huge. Very physical. But two of the best teams in the world. You know, you're going to have to meet them at some stage during the competition.
Yes,
so, unfortunately, it might have to be
I suppose you probably think about this an awful lot, and you're talking to your brother, Rob, all the time, are you? Or is he allowed to talk?
Yeah, we're keeping in touch, yeah.
Is it FaceTime or Skype or?
Just WhatsApp.
And how is he feeling?
Good. Yeah. Had a couple of niggles, like everyone else, really. You know, people are picking up little injuries here and there, but
it's a long campaign.
It is.
And what's he saying about the weather conditions, the humidity and the heat?
Yeah, he said it was incredibly hot for the Russian game. He said that before the game. You know, if you watched the games before that, you can see the amount of handling errors there were in the game because the ball is just incredibly slippy. I think he said it was pretty much like a sauna in the dome the day of the Russian game. 30 degrees outside, and then obviously inside a dome.
And what can the Irish team do to acclimatise to that?
Not much, really. No. Just acclimatise and get used to it as much as possible. We did warm weather training in pre-season. We went over to Portugal for a week. But it's pretty a different kind of heat,
it's still warm, it's not
as humid. I even remember playing in the last World Cup in the Millennium Stadium, which the roof was closed, you know, it was during the summer, but it was still very hot. You know, if you think you're going to a much warmer climate in Japan, way warmer in there, and I think the amount of errors that we've seen in all the games that have been played there because the ball is just incredibly slippy.
Do you think Ireland have played their best game yet?
No, I don't.
And that's good, I think, isn't it?
Yeah,
there's
definitely a lot more in the tank.
Yeah.
You've seen over the last couple of years what we can do. Some of the performances we've put in. At the business end now, fingers crossed, all going well. Japan do a job for us.
If Scotland beat Japan, that then we're...
Well, exactly. Well, there's so much that can happen, but just qualifying...
And were you a GAA player?
I grew up playing Gaelic, and Cooley Kickhams. Was pretty the main sport for me when I was growing up. Obviously, rugby would have been my favourite sport.
And you were on the senior team at a young age, were you?
I would have played minors, won a couple of minor championships, but kind of stopped when I was 17, 18 when I started to play Leinster under 18s, and then obviously rugby was my main focus because I was in the Clongowes and Senior Cup and all that carry on.
I read a mad article about you and your brother saying that usually it's forwards that come from farming stock and not backs.
Yeah, that's probably fair.
The bull, for example, he is a farmer.
Roy Best,
they're all from farming
Sean
stock.
O'Brien, right, Tom Furlong. I don't know why that is. Yeah, maybe we didn't eat the spuds very young.
What sort of farming did you do?
Yeah, tillage farm at home.
And will you go back to that? different rugbys?
I don't think so, to be totally honest, no. It's quieting down now a lot over the last number of years. There wouldn't be many now there. My dad would kind of be taking it on, you know, a bit of his own, a couple of people working for him. But yeah, I kind of would have been into it when I was younger, maybe in the summer. You know, I love messing around, you know, especially during harvest season. You know, driving tractors, combine harvesters and have a bit of crack. But I wouldn't really have much interest in going back to it when I'm done.
Right. Have you thought about when you're done? I know it's a good few years away. You're only 30.
Yeah, I definitely start think about it now. I've kind of got my college stuff all done.
What have you done in college?
I did business studies in DRT. Right. I guess it's kind of trying to figure out now over the next couple of years what I could be involved in. I have the two pubs, Bridge and Leyland Duke, which are great for me. Kind of, you know, good interest outside of sport, and it could be potential something for in the future.
Yeah.
But just kind of over the next couple of years, kind of meeting people and seeing what I could be interested in.
They want to know upstairs. Yourself and Rob still live together?
No, we don't.
No, right. No, you did for.
We did for around 5 years, I'd say. Yeah. So we were spending a lot of time together, working together, living together, and hanging out together. So would have seen a lot of each other, a few fights here and there.
Right.
No, I moved out a couple of years ago. Don't see much of him.
All right. When you're talking to him on WhatsApp, we'll wish him good luck with the rest of the campaign.
I will.
Yeah. And good luck to Leinster as well. And Bord Beer, it's the reason Dave is with us today is to celebrate World Egg Day.
That's it.
No. Thanks, Dave. Great talking to you.
Right.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Our 51551 Deck says rugby is a winter sport played by big, heavy guys. What are they doing playing in those conditions? It's all about the money. You're right, Deck. You look at the World Athletics Championships out in Doha, having the races at 12 o'clock midnight because it was so hot. It's all about the money. And then the World Cup in Qatar, it's all about the money, Deck. But that's the reality of modern day sport. And I would like to be able to contact Thomas, who was on the show today. I am with the Samaritans and looking to investigate a specialised service for travellers. That's what we'll put you in. That was Thomas McCann, Traveller Counselling Service, Limerick Community Development. And whenever we discuss anything to do with the travellers, I'm saddened by the negative reaction we get on text and email. And it's racism, bigotry of the highest order, and it's very upsetting. And as long as those attitudes continue, we won't be able to solve that problem that Thomas was talking about, the high occurrence of suicide within the travelling community. It's very sad. We were talking to Dominique earlier on about being a first-time mother, and great to hear this subject discussed. I had my son 9 years ago, having lost both my mother and father-in-law during the pregnancy. My public health nurse insisted that I join her breastfeeding group. I didn't want to. It wasn't for me. And, wait for it, it was the best thing I ever did. The support, honesty and friendship of those incredible women got me through a magical but incredibly tough time, and 9 years later, they're some of my best friends. Don't try to do it alone. Reach out to other mums, even if it doesn't feel like it's for you, says that person. And I'm here at home with my 9-week-old baby daughter, whom I'm so happy to hear this topic being talked about. I can really relate to this. When my baby was born, I couldn't believe the amount of people who said, the first few weeks are so hard, aren't they? But no one ever said this when I was pregnant, apart from one of my best friends who opened up to me toward the end of my pregnancy. And she warned me, this helped as I knew what I was feeling was normal. It was very hard at the beginning, sleep deprivation, bleeding nipples, loneliness, etc. I had a section and couldn't drive for the first 6 weeks, lost my independence. Now that she's older, it's getting easier. I'm really enjoying my time as a mum, but this doesn't need to be spoken about more. And that's new mum in Clonmel. Congratulations. And she says, thanks for opening up the conversation. And you are irked by Pascal's use of I. Fair enough, you tend to use ye a lot instead of the modern plural you. This sounds a bit of old-fashioned or even biblical to my ears. Regards, Jerry. He doesn't say if it annoys him or not. He's just pointing it out. That's it from us. John Murray is here with Drive Time. We're back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday.